It is my great honor and pleasure to be with all of you this evening. Could everyone hear? My special gratitude to this family, Narayan, for opening the doors of your very auspicious abode for all of us for this event. My special gratitude to these three very beautiful little angels that sang to us such purifying mantras and slokas and bhajans. It was said in the introduction that today, being Makara Sankranti, when the sun enters the northern hemisphere, was the time of the great historical event of Bhishma's great example to the world of how to depart. Because death is inevitable for everyone. In the West, when something is absolutely certain, the way of exclaiming that is, it is sure as death. Death is natural. We are born, we grow, we sustain ourselves for some time, we may produce offspring. I haven't done that in this birth. And then gradually we get older and the body dwindles and then it dies. We were speaking in the car how in the Bhagavad Purana there are many lessons that we could learn from what we see in everyday life. The moon is waxing and waning. There's Amavasya, no moon. Then there's a little sliver moon, then a quarter moon. Chaturdasi, Trayodasi. There's so many different phases of the moon as it's growing. And when it comes to its peak, it's Purnima, full moon. And then it wanes, gets smaller and smaller and smaller until Amavasya, no moon. So similarly, we are born, we grow, we reach our physical potential, and then we dwindle, and ultimately we die. But actually the moon is always Purnima. The moon is always full. It's just the reflection on the moon that we perceive that makes it look like it's getting bigger and smaller. So similarly, the Atma, the living force, the true self, Gita tells, Najayate Mriyate Vakadachit. It's neither born nor it dies. It is eternal. It is not subjected to the condition of the physical body. We are not our body, but we are in our body. And when we understand our true nature, Nahanyate Hanyamane Sarire, then we observe the various transformations of material nature in which our body is included. A little flower will bud, and then it will blossom, and then it will dwindle. It's actually beautiful to see. But when we identify with our bodies, then it's, we become very much caught up in it. But when we see reality from the perspective of truth, we had one great saint explained it this way, that this particular lifetime that we're in, it's like one point on a piece of paper, one point that's made by an extremely sharp pencil. And that point is on a line, that pencil line that goes back and forward endlessly. So when we think this little lifetime of ours is all in all, then we could really get confused why things are happening. But when we understand it's just in the truth of eternity, it's just a little point that can lead us to the highest perfection. Atato Brahma Jigyasa, this human form of life is so precious because in this little tiny amount of time, whether it be 50 years or 60 years or 100 years or even 5 years, if we just fix our consciousness on who we really are and what is our true relationship with Bhagavan, with God or with Krishna, then janma karma cha me devyam evam yo viti tatvata tyaktva deham punara janma naiti mameti surajana, then we attain the perfection of liberation and never have to take birth in the material state again. There was a great king named Katvanga. He's written about in many of the different Puranas. He perfected his life when he was told that he had one moment to live. He fixed his consciousness completely on Lord Narayan and attained the ultimate perfection. That is the blessing of this human life. It was on this day that Bhishma Dev taught us that lesson. There's a statement in Mahabharata, Mahajano Yena Katasa Panda, that if we want to understand what is the real goal of life, what is the perfection, we will never understand it even if we memorize all the Vedas. We will never understand it even if we perform such severe austerities of giving up eating and giving up sleeping and giving up sex life and giving up possessions. We will never understand it by any amount of charity. But when we follow in the footsteps of the liberated souls, the Mahajans, that is the way of understanding the highest truth. They teach us how and why to fast, how and why to perform charity, how to actually always be connected with Bhagavan in our lives. In the sixth canto of the Bhagavad Purana, it is said there are especially 12 Mahajans who are the supreme authorities of how human beings can live. And these different Mahajans were in so many different positions. Some were children, some were kings, some were sadhus. One was Bhishma. In Mahabharata, we read many, many stories about Bhishma Dev. But Srimad Bhagavat has taken the very essence of the Mahabharata. Dharma Purojita Kaitavatra. It's speaking directly how to achieve the highest, purest state. So it has explained Bhishma, especially at the time of his death. because this was his greatest lesson to the world, how we should die. And in doing so, he taught us how to live. We can only understand death when we understand life. Life is eternal. What is most important at that moment when we have to depart from this body, which is inevitable, young or old, it doesn't make that much difference, because time is not much. That is what's actually most important in life. Bhishma, from his father, Santanu, was given the blessing. Nothing could kill him. He would not die until he decided by his own sweet will to die. And it's a long story from Mahabharata, how on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, Duryodhana got Bhishma very angry one day, and Bhishma fought really hard. And he actually destroyed about half of the Pandava army in one day. And the next day he was going to destroy the rest. But Krishna, who is the Paramatma, Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridayesha Arjuna Tishtati, knows everyone's heart. He knew that Bhishma was in a very inconceivable situation, but he knew what he was actually feeling and what he really wanted. He told Yudhisthira Maharaj and the Pandavas, let us go to Yudhisthira's tent tonight, where he's resting, and ask him how we could kill him, because there's no other way. And when they asked him, Bhishma was so happy. He was smiling. He said, this is the happiest day of my life that somebody's finally come to ask me this question. I will tell you how to do it. And on the battlefield the next day, with the help of Shikhandi, Amba, Arjun filled his body with arrows from his neck to his feet. And there was not enough space between two arrows to put a single finger between. Hundreds and hundreds of arrows. And none of the arrows just went in his body. They went through his body. Half the arrow was out in the front, half the arrow was in the back. Only Arjuna could shoot that strong. And Bhishma very graciously just laid down. And because he was such an exalted person, everybody in the battlefield of Kurukshetra, the Pandavas and the Kurus, to honor him, they stopped the battle that day. And they all went to offer him respects. And then the rest of Kurukshetra battle happened. And Bhishma just waited. Krishna, after that, he went back to Hastinapur with the Pandavas, and Yudhisthira Maharaj was coronated finally after so many years to his rightful place as Dharmaraj, as the king who would lead the world in purity and truth and true Dharma, Sanatana Dharma. But Yudhisthira was not happy. He was such a humble person. He wasn't thinking Duryodhana was such an envious person. He has done so much bad to me. He deserved to die. He was not thinking Dhritarashtra lost all his children, because even though Krishna himself tried to help Dhritarashtra to give him sense, Dhritarashtra would not listen. He deserves this. Yudhisthira was thinking, because of me, everyone had to suffer so much. He took the blame of everyone's suffering and everyone's death on himself. That was his humility. And people tried to pacify him, but nobody could. Because Krishna had a plan to teach the world for all time what is Bhishma's love, so that he wouldn't be misunderstood, so that we could actually learn from him one of the most important lessons in life. And they all went back to Kurukshetra. And Bhishma, he would only die at his will. So he was just waiting. He knew that Krishna would come back. He knew, Kaunteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashati. Krishna is always there for his devotee. So he was just patiently waiting. Now, some of us have been to Kurukshetra in January. It's very cold. He was laying all alone on the battlefield because everyone else was dead. For days and days and weeks, just waiting. With arrows shot in him. Because he had total faith that Krishna will always be there for his devotee. Yudhisthira, many chapters of Mahabharata are given of his instructions, Bhishma's instructions to Yudhisthira. He taught him everything, about almost everything. How to become self-realized, how to run a family, how to be a king, how to rule over armies, everything. And he pacified him. And then Bhishma looked up in the sky and stopped speaking, because he saw that this Makara Sankranti is a very, very auspicious time. And put his full gaze on Krishna and glorified Krishna with such beautiful prayers that are forever there in the pages of the scriptures. For 5 millennia, 5,000 years, sages and pundits and devoted household people have been reciting these prayers of Bhishma. One of the things he said is, how is it possible that Yudhisthira Maharaj, who was the most pious person on earth, who was so truthful, who was the very personification of Dharma, why did he have to suffer so much? Why was he, they tried to burn him alive in the house of Lakh. They tried to poison his brother. They cheated him. They exiled him into the forest for 12 years. And he saw so much death. Why? And Bhishma the great Mahajan said, even the greatest scholars and saints, they cannot understand all these things. But this is all happening within the realm of time. But one thing is absolutely certain. We may not understand specifically why things are happening in this world, because the laws of karma are very simple in principle. When you act in a compassionate way, you get good results. When you act in a cruel way, you get painful results. Our actions and our words, there's a reaction to everything we do at every moment. That's a simple principle. But exactly how it happens, and when it happens, and where it happens, in this birth, in a future birth, what's happening to us due to this birth or past births or past births, very difficult to understand. But there are a couple truths that are always accessible to us. That the soul is eternal. The body and the mind are just temporary coverings, and that's what's going through during the waxing and waning of this physical body and mental state, the suffering and happiness. But the soul is eternal, and we are forever children of the same God, Aham Bija Pradhapita. And anyone who turns to Krishna with sincere devotion, Krishna will be there. And Bhishma was thinking of the inconceivable pastimes of Krishna. He was thinking of the gopis in Vrindavan. And he was praising Krishna in so many ways. And then, let my full, my body, my mind, my words, my full heart and my soul be offered to you, Krishna. And gazing upon the beautiful form of the Lord, he just gave him his, he gave Krishna his life and passed from the world. And according to all the great sages and saints and sadhus, and according to the scriptures itself, it was a perfect death. Because he was totally absorbed in the supreme object of all love, Bhagavan. And human life is to cultivate that consciousness and understanding that the true nature of the soul is to feel God's infinite love and to love God. In certain schools of philosophy, mukti, negation of all desires, is the highest aspiration. But in the school of bhakti, there are different levels of liberation. Negation of all desires is one level. But the most complete liberation is not only the desires, material desires are negated, but we actually transcend them to experience the infinite love of God. And then the true soul's real desires to love, to be an instrument of God's compassion, are awakened. It is the basic need of everyone to love and be loved. I often cite when I was living as a little homeless sadhu here in India. I was just coming out of my teenage years. I was about 20. When I met Mother Teresa in Calcutta, she spoke these simple words that everyone is looking for love. The greatest need is hunger. Hunger of the heart, to love and be loved. And this is the principle that was taught by all the great acharyas. The heart is starving for love because it's the nature, it's our nature to feel God's love. When a parent loves us, or when we love our parents, or when our little child loves us, or we love our little child, or when a lover loves us, or we love our lover, we know what an all-consuming experience that could be. There's nothing that can compare to it. Things can give some pleasure to the body and mind, but they cannot give pleasure to the heart. Only love can give pleasure to the heart. To give love and to receive love. The path of bhakti is the way of opening our hearts to realize the infinite, all-pervading, inconceivable, immortal love of God, of Krishna, for each and every one of us. It's there. Just like the sun. The sun is not shining for one person and not another. The sun is shining for everyone. But we can hide in a cave, or we could come out in the sunshine. That's our choice. So Krishna's love is forever being offered to everyone from within our own hearts. But we're so distracted from that love. We're so busy trying to find happiness. The happiness we're looking for is that love. But we're so busy trying to find that happiness through so many other things that we've lost connection to ourselves. What is religion? What is yoga? What is spirituality? We could call it so many things. We could give so many labels. But my Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, he used to say, true religion, true dharma, is that which awakens that love that's within our heart to realize Krishna's love. And when we realize Krishna's love, then the greatest happiness that nothing within creation could ever impede. Physically, we can be impeded. Mentally, because we have these brains we have to deal with the world through, we could be impeded. But the love of our heart, through our prayers, through our actions, through our words, according to our capacity, when we feel God's love, we just want to be an instrument of that love. Through our words, our actions, our thoughts, through our life. And how do we make that connection? Like Bhishma, through our consciousness, by making that connection, by remembering. And I'd like to, should I continue? Okay. I'd like to speak a few stories from various incarnations of our beloved Lord, which especially focus on what is the highest wealth. Yudhisthira Maharaj, when he was in the forest with nothing, he had Krishna. Duryodhana had all the armies and all the gold and the jewels and all of the power of the kingdom of the world. But who was wealthier? Yudhisthira, because he had Krishna. He had compassion. He had dharma. He had character. There's a saying, if you lose your wealth, you lose nothing. If you lose your health, you lose something. If you lose your character, you lose everything. Yudhisthira had character. During Lord Ram's time, Hanuman. What Hanuman did in his loving devotion for Sri Ram, he jumped across the Indian Ocean, which according to Valmiki's Ramayana, at that time it was 800 miles across. And then he got to Sri Lanka, and so many impediments. He was all alone. Ravana had the most powerful army in the world. He even defeated Indra. Kumbhakarna, Indrajit, so many powerful warriors, and there were millions of them, and they all had mystic powers. They had yogic cities. They had the best weapons. And Hanuman, he had just had one little club. He was alone, but he had no fear. He risked everything. He gave the message to Sita. And then he did so many extra things. He started, playing around in the Ashokva in the forest and was breaking Ravana's favorite playthings. And then he was brought before Ravana. And then he told Ravana right to his face, he was a coward. Give back Sita. If you give back Sita, Ram will protect you and love you forever. But if you don't, you and your whole dynasty will be destroyed. You are a coward. Now, to tell Ravana that in front of his wives and his ministers and his sons and his soldiers was a great insult. So Ravana said, kill the monkey. Kill him. And Vibhishan said, no, you cannot kill a messenger. Then he's tied up, light his tail on fire, and let us see him suffer to death. So they lit his tail on fire. Not just little, they wrapped and wrapped and wrapped and wrapped and wrapped so many layers of cloth, and then they soaked it in oil, and then they lit it. Fire. And Hanuman's tied up. Now, you and me, we might think, why is Ram doing this to me? I'm just trying to serve him. If he thought like that, he would have burned to death. Why is Ram doing this to me? But he was thinking, in whatever situation I'm in, how can I serve? Seek and ye shall find. If you're looking for an opportunity to serve, if you're looking for an opportunity to grow, in whatever condition you're in, happiness or distress, honor or dishonor, victory or defeat, success or failure, health or disease, these are all coming and going. It's the dualities of the world. Whoever we are, we get both sides. Just like a coin has heads and tails. Do you call like that in India too? There's heads and tails. If you want one, you get the other. You can't say, I want the heads, but I don't want the tails. You take one, you take both, because they're inseparable. If you want pleasure, pain is along with it. If you want happiness, distress is along with it. Because that's material dualities. And the spiritual liberated state, there are no dualities. The real conception of Advaita or oneness is there's one eternal truth that's filled with unlimited variegatedness, but it's all reciprocation of divine love. So Hanuman was thinking, this is a blessing, some opportunity to serve. And he made himself a little bigger. Then he made himself a little smaller, and he came out of the ropes, and he just jumped to the top of the palace. And his tail was blazing, and he touched it to the building, and the building set fire. And he had a body of a monkey. Some people may not like monkey bodies, but he was thinking, let me use it. God has given me special powers as a monkey, so he could just jump. So he jumped from one building to another, from one palace to another, and with each one, with the same flame that Ravana himself had lit on his tail, he was burning the whole city of Lanka. It's very interesting. From Ravana's side, he's the one who lit the fire. It was on his order. And it was the same fire that he lit to harm another that caused so much harm to him and all of his people. It's a good message. Whatever we do that causes harm to others, that is what is going to cause us harm. It's like lighting the tail of Hanuman. It's going to come back to us even more. After Hanuman did all that, jumped in the ocean, put his tail out, jumped all the way back, went all the way back to Ram, and Ram was in Kishkindha Kshetra. Actually, I was just there. We had a pilgrimage and about 5,000 devotees. We all went to Kishkindha Kshetra. Today it's called Hampi. And there, if you climb a high mountain, there is a cave. It's called Prashravana, also Malyavanta. That's the cave where Ram lived for the 4 months of the rainy season. And then during all the time, the weeks and weeks and weeks and months that the vanaras, the monkeys, were looking for Sita. And finally, it was that place Hanuman returned with the gift that Sita gave for Ram. And he explained the whole story. Ram was so overwhelmed. You did all of that for me? You risked your life? You gave so much pleasure to my Sita? You gave her so much hope? Ram said, I'm living as an exile. I have nothing to give you. All I have is myself. Then Lord Sri Ram embraced Hanuman. Hanuman cried in ecstasy. Ram cried in ecstasy. As they were bathing each other with their tears of love, Ram was embracing him. For Hanumanji, there was nothing else he wanted but just samsadir hari toshanam, to please his beloved Lord. That was his wealth. Ravana had a golden city. Hanuman had nothing. He didn't even have a house. But now, so many yugas later, who are we all, who do we all like, Ravana or Hanuman? He lives forever as an inspiration because his treasure was his love, his will to serve. In Krishna's Leela, there was, when Krishna was a little boy in Gokul, Mahaban, he used to see his mother, Yashoda Mai. She would like to buy things, but there was no currency at that time, especially in among the Brijbasis, because they were simple agricultural people. They grew crops, they took care of cows as their livelihood. So they would give grains or milk or different things like that and trade them for whatever else they needed. So one day, little Gopal, he was just about 2.5 years old then, a lady, a very poor lady. She didn't even live in Vrindavan, she just lived in the forest, not in the village. She had no education. She may have lived at the best in a little straw hut. She was just a very simple, uneducated lady. And the way she would survive was she would go to the forest and collect fruits and then go to the villages and sell them in a basket. So she came to Gokul. And she cried out, does anyone want to buy my fruits? And little Gopal, he grabbed a handful of wheat grains to exchange for the fruits. But he was so small and his hand was so tiny, like your daughter. How old is she? 3, so like that. So he was running really, really enthusiastically. And when he came to the fruit vendor, he said, "Give me fruit." And he held his hand out. And she looked in his hand, and there was only about one or two little grains of fruit, because as he was running, they were all falling between his fingers and from the sides of his hands, and he didn't know. So what is two grains of wheat? What is its value? Nothing. And her fruits, you know, she spends the whole day trying to find these fruits. It's her livelihood. It's not that she has like a surplus. She lives day to day. She looked at Krishna, Gopal, and he smiled at her. His beautiful lotus-like eyes gazed upon her. Satyavrat Muni in the Padma Purana describes in his Damodarastakam the beauty of little Gopal. His lips like bimba fruit, and his teeth like little pearls, he was smiling upon her. His complexion like a monsoon rain cloud. His every limb was so soft and so tender, and his little hand was like the petals of a tiny little flower. He gazed upon her with such affection. She became so attracted to little Gopal. She just wanted to make him happy. She didn't care about whether she made profits or not. Some Siddhir Haritoshanam. She just wanted to please this child. She said, "My child, please take as many fruits as you like." But his hands were so tiny, he could only hold at the most one fruit with both hands. So she put as many fruits as she could in his arms, and he was like this with all these fruits. And then he went home. This lady, it describes in Srimad Bhagavatam and Gopal Champu. Because she gave the best thing she had to please Krishna, Krishna gave her such a treasure that her basket was filled with jewels, the most precious jewels, diamonds, rubies, emeralds, lapis lazulis, pearls, not of this world, but of the celestial world. There were millions and millions of dollars worth of the best jewels in the world in her basket. But she didn't look back to see her basket. She was just so happy that she made Krishna happy. She saw when she filled Krishna's arms with fruits, he was just so happy. She said, "I must give him more happiness." So she decided, "I'm going to go back to the forest and I'm going to get more fruits to give him more to make him even more happy." So she picked up her basket, even though it weighed a huge amount of weight, she didn't even notice it. She just picked it up and ran to the forest and picked so much more fruit. And then she went to put it in the basket and she saw for the first time it was filled with priceless jewels that no kings could even have. Do you know what she did? She saw that she couldn't put any fruits for Krishna in the basket because of them. She saw no value in those jewels. She just dumped them out in the forest on the ground with no concern, and filled the basket with fruits and ran back to give it to Krishna. And she called Krishna, "Gopal, Gopal, please, I have more fruits for you. I want to make you happy." And Gopal came running back and she filled all his arms with fruits and he smiled at her. She was the highest wealth of prema. Prema, dana. prem nidhi. The greatest charity is to give love. The greatest treasure is to have love. And Krishna, he brought all these fruits home, and his mother, Yashoda Mai, she said, "Where you got all these fruits?" He told her this. He told her that there was a really old lady, and she was selling fruit, and I gave her grains. I paid for them. Yashoda Mai said, "Gopal, you're out all alone. She's a stranger. You don't know who she is. She's not even a Brijabasi. How could you just trust her? You can't think that everybody's your family." I think parents are always concerned with their little children meeting strangers. Yashoda Mai was like that too. That's why we're like that, because she's like that. Everything is coming from a source. She said, "How can you trust somebody who's a stranger?" And Gopal said to Yashoda Mai, "What does it mean to not trust somebody?" And then Yashoda Mai said, and Krishna Gopal told, "Please let us go and distribute these fruits to all of my family and all the Brijabasis." So they took the baskets of the fruits, and Yashoda Mai, just to please Gopal, were giving fruits to the Brijabasis, residents of Vrindavan. And Krishna had the little basket there, and he kept giving her, and then she'd give it to the Brijabasis, and he would give her, and she was giving thousands and thousands to everybody. And she was wondering, "Where is this fruit coming from? There was only this many, and I've given out thousands." And no matter how many people came, there was always another fruit in the basket. What does this represent? That when Krishna gives us his love, it's the most precious thing in creation. And when we give Krishna our love, to Krishna, that love is the most precious thing in creation. Krishna was so satisfied with the love of that simple little forest lady, and her love was within the fruits. He wanted to share her love with all the Brijabasis. And there were unlimited fruits to share, because he considered her love to be unlimited. This is true wealth. To receive love, to give love. The second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam describes how when you water the root of a tree, that water goes to every part of the tree, the leaves, the branches, the flowers. And similarly, when we offer our love to Bhagavan, aham sarvasya prabhavo matta sarvam pravartite iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells, "I'm the source of all material and all spiritual worlds. Everything emanates from me." The wise who know this perfectly worship me with all their hearts. Krishna is the root. Janmadhyasya yataha. Brahma Sutra tells, the absolute truth from everything. Everything is coming from the absolute truth. So when we offer our love to God, our love naturally extends to all living beings. And that when love is extended to all living beings in this world, it is in the spirit of compassion, truly being the well-wisher of others, trying to share what we have with others. That is what gives happiness to the soul. That is what gives true happiness to the heart, to love and to be loved. Bhishma understood that. At his last moment, he just offered his love to Krishna. And everyone there could see that he had attained the highest perfectional state. In this age of Kali, Krishna has appeared in so many ways, in his words, in his temples, but especially in the divine names. Harinama, 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 Eva Kevalam, Kalo Nasteva, 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 Gatiranyata. That in this age of Kali, the most powerful and accessible form of Dharma is to awaken the love within our heart by chanting God's names. Chetodarpanamarjanam. It cleans the heart, the ecology of the heart, of its lust and envy and greed and arrogance and illusion, and allows the true qualities of the soul, the true qualities of God's love to shine through us. Anandam buddhivardhanam. If we have the association of people who really inspire us, satsang, it gives us the faith and the joy to actually apply spiritual principles to our lives. Satsang sadhana. Through satsang, we get the faith and direction. Through sadhana, we have a spiritual practice where we actually put some precious time every day, especially to fix our mind on God's grace. And it's especially easy through the chanting of God's names. And then sadachar. Then we live with character, with integrity. And we understand, whether we're simple swamis or monks, or whether we're kings, or whether we have nothing or millions or billions or trillions, if we understand that everything is God's property, I'm a caretaker, let me use it in such a way that Krishna's pleased, and that we can help please Krishna's children. That consciousness, which is available to everyone in any condition, in any social status, that simple lady had no education, but she attained highest perfection just by giving her little fruits to Krishna. Patram pushpam palam toya. And Yudhisthira, Prahlad Maharaj was a little boy. And when he was offered any benediction by Narasingha, he said, I don't want anything. But Narasingha said, but you should become the king. You should get married, you should have a family, and you should become the king of the entire world. And he did. So whether we're kings or whether we're sadhus, grihe tako, vane tako, if we have the satsang and we have the name of God in our heart, in life, in death, we are the most wealthy and most happy people. And to share that happiness is the greatest of all joys. So this is some thoughts I have on this special day of Makar Sankranti. Thank you very much. I am seeing this photo of Ananda Mayima, and I'm remembering how much she loved kirtan. I lived with her in Dehradun, and briefly in Delhi, and again in Vrindavan. And when I saw her in Vrindavan, I had already accepted the path of devotion in my life. And we all went to see her, and she sat in a little chair, and for about 45 minutes, she just chanted, Gopal. She just, Gopala, 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 Gopala. And we went, Gopala, Gopala, Gopala. And after about an hour of chanting kirtan, she just said, always keep Krishna's names in your heart. Thank you very much.
We will throw the floor open for any questions that you may want to ask, either in public or after a while in private. Is there?
Several, actually.
Actually, Swamiji has written a book called The Journey Home, which basically is a wonderfully written tale of all the adventures that he had from the time he started from his home in the US. He was born to a Jewish family and then traveled through Europe and the Middle East all the way to India in search of that question. And that book, we have a copy of that book. If you would like to know more about everything that he experienced.
I can tell you one thing that happened. When I was living in Himalayas, I fasted for several weeks. And at the end of the fast, someone gave me 1 rupee. Because I didn't have any money. And I really liked peanuts. So I went to this little shop that I had seen once when I was walking around that sold peanuts. And because I was from America, 1 rupee in those days was, there was 8 rupees to a dollar in those days. Seven rupees to a dollar. But on the black market, you can get about 8.5. But I never had any rupees to exchange, so I was naturally very law-abiding. But that much, you'd get this many peanuts in America. So I was expecting like that. But this person, when he saw 1 rupee, he was very happy. He was near Chotiwala. And he took newspapers. I was wondering, what is he doing? Because I was new to India. I was just sitting on bank of Ganga, living in a cave in the forest. So I had just arrived, so I was not yet familiar with how things are done. So he started taking newspapers, and he made a bag this big out of newspapers, and he filled it to the top with peanuts. They were in the shells. He roasted them in sand and fire. And I was thinking, oh, so nice. So many. I fasted so long, and now I have so many peanuts. And because I was only 19, 20, I could eat a lot of peanuts in those days. So I was really happy. And I was bringing the peanuts back, because sadhus don't eat just like while they're walking. I was living in a cave in forest. I'll bring it back to the cave, and I will have such a feast of peanuts tonight. So I was walking through the forest, and suddenly a very large brown male monkey jumped in front of me, like a customs agent. And he blocked my path, and he showed his teeth, and he looked at me. He had green eyes, and he was really looking angry, and he made this scream. And I'm standing there with this bag of peanuts, and suddenly he jumped right at me. And he grabbed the peanut bag, and with his feet, he kicked me in the chest, and I went falling backward. And he took the whole bag of peanuts. But while he did that, about 15 peanuts fell on the ground. And I was thinking, at least I get these. But when I was about to do that, these little monkeys came running, and they picked all the peanuts in the ground and ran away. So I was left with nothing. And my stomach was churning. And I was walking. And I thought, God, what am I supposed to learn from this? And then if we really want to learn, God reveals so many beautiful messages through life's experiences. If I said, I was so hungry, now I don't have anything, now I have to starve, and that monkey was so selfish and everything, I wouldn't have learned anything. But I put my mind and senses aside, and with my heart, I was thinking, God, what am I supposed to learn? And then a thought came to my mind that during my meditation and my prayer, I got so many beautiful gifts that enriched my life so much. Compared to what God has already given me, what are these peanuts? And I was thinking, the peanuts of material acquisition, in whatever form they are, in due course of time, they're all going to be stolen away from us, from one type of monkey or another. It may be the monkey of other people, maybe the monkey of tax collectors, it may be the monkey of economic collapse, or eventually it's going to be the monkey of death. But the great jewel, the great wealth, the great prize of any connection we have with God is so infinitely more valuable than the peanuts of the things of this world. And since that day, that was 45 years ago, that happened in January of 1970. I didn't have a calendar, but this may be the anniversary. But since that time, I've considered that monkey one of my gurus. He taught me such a valuable lesson. And with that lesson, even though I was still just as hungry as before, I was happy hungry. Otherwise, you could be miserable hungry. We have that choice. And since I wrote this book, The Journey Home, so many places I go, people give me gifts of peanuts. I was in New York City, and I gave a lecture. And this one American man, he's a very kind of wealthy person, and very maybe in his mid-20s, late-20s, he came up to me and he had this beautiful box, really beautiful box with ribbons around it, and he said, I want to give you this gift. And then he bowed down. He was not a devotee he was just a person who was a businessman. I think he was about 30. And I opened it, and there was a little note that said that I read your book, and I felt so bad that the monkey took your peanuts. I wanted to buy you peanuts. And it was a bag of peanuts. And you know what was really interesting about it? Because in peanuts grow in America, in Georgia, in so many places. There's unlimited peanuts in America. I looked at the peanut bag, and they were imported from India. He wanted to give me as close as possible exactly the peanuts that monkey stole from me. So eventually everything comes back to us. That's Would anyone else like to ask a question? Please.
To the USA, but he attained something. He taught the joy of computers, at that low price that people could get. So, and there have been many seekers from the West who have come to India, and they have had different experiences. What was the difference in, that means you realized God, but Steve Jobs didn't realize he went back, but still he could attain something. I don't understand the difference between the two, you and him, because both of you attend something which is beyond an ordinary person. I don't know whether I'm making myself clear, because I'm confused. That means both of you had come with the same goal, but you got it and he didn't, but still he went, he achieved something. He could teach the world.
India has such a deep and rich spiritual heritage. And for someone like him, his coming to India, his meeting the sadhus in India, his praying in India, he attributed that he got special shakti and special blessings here. And according to his desires, those blessings empowered him to do what he did. From a technological, scientific perspective, actually changed the society of this planet, the things that he created. And he attributed it to certain, not only his hard work, because a lot of people work hard, and a lot of people work much harder than he did, but they don't accomplish what he did. There was a special karma and a special blessing, and he received very special potencies and blessings here in India. And he took it back and manifested according to his desire, because he wanted to. His will, by taking the blessings of India, was to, he was initially looking for God, but overriding that desire to find God, he wanted to create these computers. And he did. It's the power of Mother India. And my little self, I just wanted to serve. I never really wanted anything for myself. And while some people are serving with great wealth or great academic knowledge, I never had those aspirations. And by Krishna's grace, he fulfilled my desires too. I could serve by just trying to help enlighten people with this wisdom that I have received from my guru and so many of my teachers. So I think that God has fulfilled both of our desires. Does that answer your question?
What made you leave your home? Was there a spiritual background or something like that, or at that young age? What made you leave home with such a strong conviction?
I don't know, actually. I just did it. But it was a time when there were many questions in my mind. My brothers, who grew up in the same house as me, one's a businessman, the other's a musician, they're nothing like this. All my friends, some are pilots, some are in business, some are in science. When I grew up, I never really knew anybody who was deeply religious. Religion was just being pious. My parents were religious in the sense that they had values. But as far as the idea of God and seeking God and realizing God, I never heard anything like that in my life. It wasn't part of where I was. But I saw a lot of racial discrimination, prejudice against minorities. I saw a lot of hypocrisy. And I saw so much emptiness in people, even if they had so much. I even saw hate in the name of a loving God. So these things troubled me. And because I was troubled by them, I just couldn't be satisfied just going along with how things were. I had to, as Gandhi said, be the change I wanted to see in the world. And I was looking for that change by being part of social activism, ideologies, revolutions, counterculture. But what I was connecting with was very superficial. And I came to a conclusion in my own life when I was a teenager that this change that I was looking for in the world, that I had to find in myself, had to be something spiritual. But in order to do it, I really have to go deep. So I started traveling to other countries to understand how other people outside of my own land, what is their conception of God? What is their conception of race, races and minorities, and what is their conception of America, where I'm from? What is real happiness? And I was going to synagogues and churches and cathedrals and monasteries and forests, and then I started hitchhiking to India, and I was going to masjids in the Middle East, and I went to the Himalayas, and I was studying Buddhism, and I was studying Burmese Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism, and I was living with yogis and Shivites and Nagas, and ultimately I came to Vrindavan and I found Radha and Krishna, and I was thinking, this is everything I'm looking for. I just want to open my heart to receive this and share this with the world. And then I found my guru, Srila Prabhupada. So, I guess to answer your question, maybe it was a previous life, but I just wasn't satisfied with all the things everybody around me were satisfied with. I was looking for something more. When I was sleeping on a riverbank in Vrindavan, I'll never forget this incident. I write about it in the book. I was just sleeping in the riverbank. No blanket, no sleeping bags, just on the ground. And all I had was clothes like this. And it was winter. It was January. And I was sleeping there. It was freezing cold, and I just would go very tight and sleeping. And I remember one night, while I was doing that every night, I had a dream that I was back in a beautiful home in America. And in the dream, I was thinking, why did I leave Vrindavan? Why am I here? This is terrible. I've left Vrindavan, I'm here. And I was in so much anguish. I was rolling around and rolling around. And then I woke up and I was thinking, why did I leave Vrindavan? Why am I here? I'm in this big, beautiful home and everything. Where is my riverbank? I just want my riverbank. And then I saw, I'm still on the riverbank. And I thought, oh, I'm so happy I'm still here. So I found my calling there. And everybody has their calling. And we're all unique and we're all different. And you know what I realized? That I actually never really had to leave America to find what I was looking for. I could have worked for my father's business and found what I was looking for, because it's within our heart. But this is the journey that Krishna put me on. Does that answer your question?
Swamiji, why did the Pandavas, when they were exiled, why did they go back to the material world? Or why did they want to go back to the material world and win back Indraprastha?
Because of their compassion. Duryodhana had usurped their kingdom by completely immoral means. And his example as a leader was one of envy and exploitation. And he was against the will of God. It was Krishna's compassion that he wanted a ruler who actually loved every one of his citizens as his own children. That was Yudhisthira. When he became king, he considered every animal, every insect, every bird, and every type of human being, whatever their particular status was, whatever their sex was, whatever their intelligence was, he considered everyone his child. They're all Krishna's children. And being a king, I am entrusted to take care of them and give them every possibility of happiness and lead them to live a prosperous loving life. That was his calling. He didn't go back to live in a palace. He didn't go back to become rich. He became rich, and he did live in a palace. But he did it all to serve humanity and to serve God. And he could serve in such a more powerful way as a king than he could just living in the forest. And his nature, he was a kshatriya. His nature was to rule. He wasn't just a simple Brahmin. He did not want the battle. He was willing to concede in every possible way, but Duryodhana forced him to have that battle because Duryodhana was so stubborn and so cruel and so envious. So it was for dharma and it was for service and it was for compassion that he came out of the forest. And as soon as he had a son, or a grandson, Parikshit, who could rule the kingdom as good as him, what did he do? He went to the forest.
Point in the Mahabharata where they asked for 5 villages, 1 village for each of the Pandavas. How would that achieve the goal of being an honorable ruler?
That was the ultimate degree in which he was trying to avoid that war.
Could have avoided the war by not going back at all.
If he could have one little village, he was willing to accept that. But Duryodhana was so envious and so bad, he said, I will not give them enough land you could put the head of a needle in. If Duryodhana even had a trace of goodness, he would have let it be, but he didn't. It was Krishna's will.
One last one. Why did Bhishma Pitama wait till the last moment to realize God?
He had already realized God long before. But it came to its culmination at that point.
Why did he fight backing the folks that were fighting against dharma?
The acharyas explain. It's something that takes some spiritual advancement to understand. Bhishma was such a completely surrendered person to Krishna. He knew that the Pandavas would win. And he stated it. He told Duryodhana, if Krishna's on the side of the Pandavas, they will win. Even if I'm your commander-in-chief, still we will be defeated. He knew that. So why did he fight on the other side anyway? He knew that he was going to go back to the spiritual world. Because of his love and surrender to Krishna. He had that connection. But he understood Krishna. Krishna wanted to teach the world a special lesson. even Bhishma was the most powerful man on earth. He was the most intelligent man on earth. He was the greatest fighter on earth. When he was fighting in Kurukshetra, the Pandavas, it's compared to this. No matter how strong you are, or wealthy you are, or famous you are, or beautiful you are, if there is a tsunami coming toward you, what can you do? If there's a cyclone coming toward you, all you could do is watch it destroy everything. Can you stop it? Can you stop a cyclone? When the Pandavas saw Bhishma fighting, even Bhima himself just stood like this. There's nothing we could do. This man is the most powerful man on earth. He's Parasaram's disciple. He's so powerful. Krishna wanted to teach, however powerful, however intelligent, however great, if you're not on the side of Dharma, in due course of time, you're going to lose. To teach the world that lesson forever, Bhishma knew, this is the lesson that Krishna wants to teach, so I will be on the wrong side to help him teach this lesson. Because by all material considerations, it was absolutely impossible for the Pandavas to win that battle because Bhishma was on the other side. Yes? They were outnumbered and they had inferior soldiers. But Yudhisthira was on the side of Dharma. And Krishna is on the side of those who have Dharma. And no matter how materially we try to work this out, it never works. Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, it's a continuous message. It was Bhishma's love. I'll take the other side just to teach the world this lesson. Because no one could teach it as good as me. That's the message the great acharyas and pundits teach us of why Bhishma took the other side. On a more superficial level, because Duryodhana was maintaining him and feeding him, and because Duryodhana was the emperor, he was obliged to be on the other side. But Bhishma was actually beyond all that. He was willing to be misunderstood forever if he could be an instrument to teach the world the lesson of Dharma. Does that answer your question?
It does. I had a different interpretation of it. I was under the impression that he had made a promise to his father that he would leave Indraprastha in the right hands. And so he defended it till it got to the right hands, which was Yudhishthira's hands in the end. And so he did his duty, even though it meant fighting against Dharma. And, you know, he lived his life doing his duty, which is the lesson that Gita teaches you. And then in the end, when his duty was done, is the time when he realized God. That's how I would think about it.
We're saying the same things, just different levels of the same truths. Thank you.
Swamiji, then I'll ask one last question. Through this conversation, the undercurrent of it has been that as we go about living our lives through all its dualities, through its happinesses and through its sorrows, the spirit that should be a guiding spirit should be the spirit of gratitude, that we have to keep realize how much grace has flown into our lives, how much we have to be thankful for. And yet, even when you know it, it is very difficult to be centered with that. Is there anything that we should do, we should follow, that would help us keep with this thought?
Thank you. Your answer is within your question. To be grateful. A grateful heart is a heart that could see the light even in apparent darkness. A grateful heart is one in which the seed of love, the seed of devotion, the seed of truth can actually take deep roots in our heart and grow and become a great flower of wisdom and realization. In order to be grateful, we require humility. If we're not humble, if we're arrogant, whatever we get, it, we always think I deserve something else. Yes? A humble heart, whatever we get, we're grateful for the opportunities that are within that. A humble heart turns to God. Queen Kunti, the mother of the Pandavas, she prayed to Krishna. Janmaishwarya Shruti Shribir Edamana Madapuman Narvaiha Twam Akinshana Gocharam. Which means the greatest disqualifications for spiritual life are a high birth and fame, high education, wealth, and beauty. Akinchana Gocharam. You only reveal yourself to those who are impoverished. What does she mean? Because she spoke this just after Yudhisthira was coronated as the emperor of the world. Prahlad was made the emperor. In fact, so many of the greatest saints that we read about, Ranti Dev is the personification of compassion and self and enlightenment. He was a king. You know the story of Ambarish. Durvas Muni had nothing. Ambarish was a king, and Ambarish was seen to be so saintly. So what is Kunti saying? It's saying that if we become proud, it's not the wealth or the high education or the fame, it's the tendency to become proud, arrogant, because I have more than someone else. And when we become proud and arrogant, we can't be grateful for anything. We can no longer be humble. And we can't really call out for God's grace. It's not the fame or the education or the wealth. It's the arrogance, thinking, this is mine. I have more than you. Therefore, I'm better than you. Or you have more than me. I'm envious. I want what you have. A grateful heart cannot think like that. A grateful heart, whether we're a billionaire or whether we're a simple little farmer, a grateful heart is happy with the opportunity to serve. A grateful heart could turn to God. Thank you for the sunshine. Thank you for the air I'm breathing. Thank you for the water I'm drinking. Thank you for the food I'm eating. If I, when if you're living in the forest and you're getting one chapati and you're grateful to God for that chapati, you're happier than living in a palace and eating on golden plates and not grateful. But if you're living in a palace eating on golden plates and grateful for what you're receiving, it's the same. It really doesn't make any difference. What makes a difference is that we're grateful. Because in any situation, do we not have the sunshine? Do we not have eyes to see? Do we not have hands to do seva? Do we not have a tongue to speak? Do we not have anyone who likes us or loves us or care about us? Every little thing we should be grateful for. That gratitude not only brings happiness and fulfillment in any state in our life, but it also opens our heart to receive Krishna's grace at every moment. Without gratitude, spirituality is just something material. It's just a material form without any substance. So how to keep grateful? I think that's what you're asking. By cultivating it. Just like if you have a little flower and you want it to grow, you have to keep the soil fertile and you have to keep giving it water and you have to keep giving it sunlight. Otherwise, it's going to die. Yes? So gratitude is like a little seed in our heart. Bhakti is like a seed in our heart. Bhakti lata. And it needs to be cultivated. How do we water it? The water is by our spiritual practice. But we have to have our spiritual practice with the right intention. By hearing the message of Krishna, Harikatha, by chanting the names of God, by performing our meditation, Dhyan, by offering sincere prayers, Bandhanam, by offering seva, by doing our worship at home with a real desire to serve and to please the Lord and to connect with the Lord, puja. These are all sadhana. It's like the water that nourishes that seed of gratitude, humility, and devotion. And it needs sunshine too. By coming to satsangs, that's like the sunshine. So if we give the sunshine of satsang, if we give the water of sadhana, if we keep it fertile by our good behavior and our sadachar, then even in the storms of the world, our gratitude, our love, our realizations will keep growing and growing and growing. But it doesn't happen automatically. Just like a flower doesn't grow automatically. It needs sunshine and water. And it needs good soil. So that is our way of keeping connected and in every situation. Because it's so easy to lose that virtue of gratitude. Unless we cultivate it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. It does. Thank you so much, Swamiji.
Thank you.